The Lurking Fear by H.P. Lovecraft. Chapter 1. The Shadow on the Chimney. There was thunder in the air on the night I went to the deserted mansion atop Tempest Mountain to find the Lurking Fear. I was not alone, for foolhardiness was not then mixed with that love of the grotesque and the terrible which has made my career a series of quests for strange horrors in literature and in life. With me were two faithful and muscular men for whom I had sent when the time came. Men long associated with me in my ghastly explorations because of their peculiar fitness. We had started quietly from the village because of the reporters who still lingered about after the eldritch panic of a month before, the nightmare creeping death. Later, I thought they might aid me, but I did not want them then. Would to God had I let them share the search, that I might not have had to bear the secret alone so long. To bear it alone for fear the world would call me mad or go mad itself at the demon implications of the thing. Now that I am telling it anyway, lest the brooding make me a maniac, I wish I had never concealed it. For I, and I only, know what manner of fear lurked on the spectral and desolate mountain. In a small motor car, we covered the miles of primeval forest and hill until the wooded ascent checked it. The country bore an aspect more than unusually sinister as we viewed it by night and without the accustomed crowds of investigators, so that we were often tempted to use the acetylene headlight despite the attention it might attract. It was not a wholesome landscape after dark, and I believe I would have noticed its morbidity even had I been ignorant of the terror that stalked there. Of wild creatures there were none. They were wise when death leers close. The ancient lightning-scarred trees seemed unnaturally large and twisted, and the other vegetation unnaturally thick and feverish, while curious mounds and hummocks in the weedy, fulgurite pitted earth remind me of snakes and dead men's skulls swelled to gigantic proportions. Fear had lurked on Tempest Mountain for more than a century. This I learned at once from the newspaper accounts of the catastrophe which had first brought the region to the world's notice. The place is a remote, lonely elevation in that part of the Catskills where Dutch civilization once feebly and transiently penetrated, leaving behind as it receded only a few ruined mansions and a degenerate squatter population inhabiting pitiful hamlets on isolated slopes. Normal beings seldom visited the locality till the state police were formed. And even now, only infrequent troopers patrol it. The fear, however, is an old tradition throughout the neighbouring villages, since it is a prime topic in the simple discourse of the poor mongrels who sometimes leave their valleys to trade hand-woven baskets for such primitive necessities as they cannot shoot, raise, or make. The Lurking Fear dwelt in the shunned and desert Martens mansion, which crowned in the high but gradual eminence whose liability to frequent thunderstorms gave it the name of Tempest Mountain. For over 100 years the antique grove-circled stone house had been subject of stories incredibly wild and monstrously hideous. Stories of a silent, colossal, creeping death which stalked abroad in the summer. With whimpering insistence, the squatters told tales of demon which seized lone wayfarers after dark, either carrying them off or leaving them in a frightful state of gnawed dismemberment, or sometimes they whispered of blood trails towards the distant mansion. Some said that the thunder called the Lurking Fear out of its habitation, while others said that the thunder was its voice. No one outside the backwoods had believed these varying and conflicting stories, with their incoherent, extravagant descriptions of the half-glimpsed fiend. Yet not a farmer or villager doubted that the Martens mansion was ghoulishly haunted. Local history forbade such doubt, although no ghostly evidence was ever found by such investigators as had visited the building after some especially vivid tale of the squatters. Grandmothers told strange myths of the Martens spectre, myths concerning the Martens family itself, its queer hereditary dissimilarity of eyes, its long unnatural annals, and the murder which had cursed it. The terror which brought me to the scene was a sudden portentous confirmation of the mountaineer's wildest legends. One summer night, after a thunderstorm of unprecedented violence, the countryside was aroused by a squatter stampede, which no mere delusion could create. The pitiful throngs of natives shrieked and whined of the untamable horrors which had descended upon them, and they were not doubted. They had not seen it, but had heard such cries from one of the hamlets that they knew a creeping death had come. In the morning, citizens and straight troopers followed the shuddering mountaineers to the place where they said the death had come. Death was indeed there. The ground under one of the squatters' villages had caved in after a lightning stroke, destroying several of the malodorous shanties. But upon this property damage, whose superimposed an organic devastation which paled it to insignificance. Of a possible 75 natives who had inhabited this spot, not one living specimen was visible. The disordered earth was covered with blood and human debris, bespeaking too vividly the ravages of demon teeth and talons. Yet no visible trail led away from the carnage. That some hideous animal must be the cause, everyone quickly agreed. Nor did any tongue now revive the charge that such cryptic deaths formed merely the sordid murders common in decadent communities. That charge was revived only when about 25 of the estimated population were found missing from the dead. And even then it was hard to explain the murder of 50 by half that number. But the fact remained that on a summer night a bolt had come out of the heavens and left a dead village whose corpses were horribly mangled, chewed and clawed. The excited countryside immediately connected the horror with the haunted Martens mansion, though the localities were over 3 miles apart. The troopers were more sceptical, including the mansion only casually in their investigations and dropping it altogether when they found it thoroughly deserted. Country and village people, however, canvassed the place with infinite care, overturning everything in the house, sounding the ponds and brooks, spreeting down bushes and ransacking the nearby forest. All was in vain. The death that had come had left no trace save destruction itself. By the second day of the search, the affair was fully treated by the newspapers, whose reporters overran Tempest Mountain. They described it in much detail, and with many interviews to elucidate the horror's history as told by the local grandams. I followed the accounts languidly at first, for I am a connoisseur in horrors, but after a week I detected an atmosphere which stirred me oddly. So that on August the 5th, 1921, I registered among the reporters who crowded the hotels at Lefer's Corner, nearest village to Tempest Mountain, and acknowledged headquarters of the searchers. 3 weeks more, and the dispersal of the reporters left me free to begin a terrible exploration based on the minute inquiries and surveying which I had meanwhile busied myself with. So, on this summer night, while a distant thunder rumbled, I left a silent motor car and tramped with 2 armed companions up the last mound-covered reaches of Tempest Mountain. casting the beams of an electric torch on the spectral grey walls that began to appear through giant oaks ahead. In this morbid night solitude, a feeble shifting illumination, the vast box-like pile displayed obscure hints of terror which day could not uncover. Yet I did not hesitate, since I had come with fierce resolution to test an idea. I believed that the thunder called the death demon out of some fearsome secret place, and be that demon solid entity or vaporous pestilence, I meant to see it. I had thoroughly searched the ruin before, hence knew my plan well, choosing as the seat of my vigil the old room of Jan Martens, whose murder looms so great in the rural legend. I felt subtly that the apartment of this ancient victim was best for my purpose. The chamber, measuring about 20 feet square, contained, like the other rooms, some rubbish which had once been furniture. It lay on the second story, on the southeast corner of the house, and had an immense east windows and narrow south windows, both devoid of panes or shutters. Opposite the large window was an enormous Dutch fireplace with scriptural tiles representing the prodigal son, and opposite the narrow window was a spacious bed built into the wall. As the tree-muffled thunder grew louder, I arranged my plan's details. First, I fastened side by side to the ledge of the large window 3 rope ladders, which I had brought with me. I know they reached a suitable spot on the grass outside, for I had tested them. Then the 3 of us dragged from another room a wide 4-posted bedstead, crowding it laterally against the windows. Having strewn it with furbo, all that now rested on it was drawn automatics, 2 relaxing while the 3rd watched. From whatever direction the demon might come, our potential escape was provided. If it came from within the house, we had the window ladders. If from outside, the door and the stairs. We did not think, judging from precedent, that it would pursue us even far at the worst. I watched from midnight to 1 o'clock, when in spite of the sinister house, the unprotected window, and the approaching thunder and lightning, I felt singularly drowsy. I was between my 2 companions, George Bennett being towards the window, and William Toby towards the fireplace. Bennett was asleep, having apparently felt the same anomalous drowsiness which afflicted me. So I designated Toby for the night watch, although even he was nodding. It is curious how intently I had been watching that fireplace. The increasing thunder must have affected my dreams, for in brief time I slept there came to me apocalyptic visions. Once I partly awakened, probably because the sleeper toward the window had restlessly flung an arm across my chest. I was not sufficiently awake to see whether Toby was attending to his duties as sentinel, but felt a distinct anxiety on that score. Never before had the presence of evil so poignantly impressed me. Later, I must have dropped asleep again, for it was out of the phantasmal chaos that my mind leaped when the night grew hideous with shrieks beyond anything in my former experience or imagination. In that shrieking, the inmost soul of human fear and agony clawed hopelessly and insanely at the ebony gates of oblivion. I awoke to red madness and the mockery of diabolism as farther and farther down inconceivable vistas that phobic and crystalline anguish retreated and reverberated. There was no light, but I knew from the empty space at my right that Toby was gone. God alone knew whither. Across my chest still lay the heavy arm of the sleeper at my left. Then came a devastating stroke of lightning which shook the whole mountain, lit the darkest crypts of the hoary grove, and splintered the patriarch of the twisted trees. In the demon flash of a monstrous fireball, the sleeper started up suddenly, while the glare from beyond the window threw his shadow vividly upon the chimney above the fireplace, from which my eyes had never strayed. That I am still alive and sane is a marvel I cannot fathom. I cannot fathom it, for the shadow on the chimney was not that of George Bennett or of any other human creature, but a blasphemous abnormality from hell's nevermost craters, a nameless, shapeless abomination which no mind could fully grasp and no pen could ever partly describe. In another second I was alone in the accursed mansion, shivering and gibbering. George Bennett and William Toby had left no trace, not even of a struggle. They were never heard of again. Chapter 2. A Passer in the Storm. For days after that hideous experience in the forest-swathed mansion, I lay nervously exhausted in my hotel room at Lefert's Corner. I do not remember exactly how I managed to reach the motor car, start it, and slip unobserved back to the village, for I retain no distinct impressions save of wild arm trees and demonic mutterings of thunder and Charonian shadows athwart with low mounds that dotted and streaked the Lee region. As I shivered and brooded on the casting of that brain-blasting shadow, I knew that I had at last pried out one of Earth's supreme horrors, one of those nameless blights of outer voids whose faint demon scratchings we sometimes hear on the farthest rim of space, yet from which our own finite visions give us a merciful immunity. The shadow I had seen, I hardly dared to analyze or identify. Something had lain between me and the window that night, but I shuddered whenever I could not cast off the instinct to classify it. If it had only snarled or bayed or laughed titteringly, even that would have relieved the abysmal hideousness. But it was so silent. It rested a heavy arm or foreleg on my chest. Obviously it was organic, or had once been organic. Jan Martens, whose room I had invaded, was buried in that graveyard near the mansion. I must find Bennett and Toby, if they lived. Why had it picked them and left me for the last? Drowsiness is so stifling, and the dreams are so horrible. In a short time, I realized that I must tell my story to someone or break down completely. I had already decided not to abandon the quest for the lurking fear, for in my rash ignorance it seemed to me that uncertainty was worse than enlightenment, however terrible the latter might prove to be. Accordingly, I resolved in my mind that the best course to pursue, whom to select for my confidences, and how to track down the thing which had obliterated two men and cast a nightmare shadow. My chief acquaintances at Lefer Corner had been the affable reporters, of whom several still remained to collect final echoes of the tragedy. It was from these that I determined to choose a colleague, and the more I reflected, the more my preference inclined towards one Arthur Munro, a dark, lean man of about 35, whose education, taste, intelligence, and temperament all seemed to mark him as one not bound by conventional ideas and experiences. On an afternoon in early September, Arthur Munro listened to my story. I saw from the beginning that he was both interested and sympathetic, and when I had finished, he analysed and discussed the thing with the greatest shrewdness and judgment, His advice, moreover, was eminently practical, for he recommended a postponement of operations at the Martens mansion until we might become fortified with more detailed historical and geographical data. On his initiative, we combed the countryside for information regarding the terrible Martens family and discovered a man who possessed a marvellously illuminating ancestral diary. We also talked at length with such of the mountain mongrels as had not fled from the terror and confusion to remoter slopes, and arranged to proceed with our culminating task. The exhaustive and definitive examination of the mansion in the light of its detailed history, with an equally exhaustive and definitive examination of spots associated with the various tragedies of squatter legend. The results of this examination were not at first very enlightening, though our tabulation of them seemed to reveal a fairly significant trend. Namely, that the number of reported horrors was by far the greatest in areas either comparatively near the avoided house or connected with it by stretches of morbidly overnourished forest. There were, it is true, exceptions. Indeed, the horror that which had caught the world's ear had happened in a treeless space, remote alike from the mansion and from any connecting woods. As to the nature and appearance of the lurking fear, nothing could be gained from the scared and witless shanty dwellers. In the same breath, they called it a snake and a giant, a thunder devil and a bat, a vulture and a walking tree. We did, however, deem ourselves justified in assuming that it was a living organism, highly susceptible to electrical storms. And although certain of the stories suggested wings, we believe that its aversion for open spaces made a land locomotion a more probable theory. The only thing really incompatible with the latter view was the rapidity with which the creature must have travelled in order to perform all the deeds attributed to it. When we came to know the squatters better, we found them curiously likeable in many ways. Simple animals they were, gently descending the evolutionary scale because of their unfortunate ancestry and stultifying isolation. They feared outsiders, but slowly grew accustomed to us, finally helping vastly when we beat down all the thickets and tore out all the partitions of the mansion in our search for the lurking fear. When we asked them to help us find Bennett and Toby, they were truly distressed, for they wanted to help us, yet knew that these victims had gone as wholly out of their world as of their own missing people, that great numbers of them had actually been killed and removed, just as the wild animals had long been exterminated. We were, of course, thoroughly convinced, and we waited apprehensively for further tragedies to occur. By the middle of October, we were puzzled by our lack of progress. Owing to the clear night, no demoniac aggressions had taken place, and the completeness of our vain searches of house and country almost drove us to regard the lurking fear as a non-material agency. We feared that the cold weather would come on and halt our explorations, for all agreed that the demon was generally quiet in winter. Thus, there was a kind of haste and desperation in the last daylight canvas of the horror-visited hamlet, a hamlet now deserted because of the squatter's fears. The ill-fated squatter hamlet had borne no name, but had long stood in a sheltered, though treeless, cleft between two elevations called respectively Cone Mountain and Maple Hill. It was closer to Maple Hill than to Cone Mountain, some of the crude abodes indeed being dugouts on the side of the former eminence. Geographically, it lay about 2 miles northwest of the base of the Tempest Mountain, and 3 miles from the oak-girt mansion. Of the distance between the hamlet and the mansion, fully 2 miles and a quarter on the hamlet side was entirely open country, the plain being of fairly level character, save for some of the low snake-like mounds, and having as vegetation only grass and scattered weeds. Considering this topography, we had finally concluded that the Daemon must have come by the way of Stone Mountain, a wooded southern prolongation of which ran to within a short distance of the westernmost spur of Taupus Mountain. The upheaval of ground we traced conclusively to the landslide from Maple Hill, a tall, lone, splintered tree on whose side had been the striking point of the thunderbolt which summoned the fiend. As for the 20th time or more, Arthur Munro and I went minutely over every inch of violated village. We were filled with a certain discouragement coupled with a vague and novel fears. It was acutely uncanny, even when frightful and uncanny things were common, to encounter so blankly clueless a scene after such overwhelming occurrences. And we moved about beneath the leaden, darkening sky with that tragic, directionless zeal which results from a combined sense of futility and necessity of action. Our care was gravely minute. Every cottage was again entered, every hillside dug out, again searched for bodies, every thorny foot of adjacent slope again scanned for dens and caves, but all without result. And yet, as I have said, vague new fears hovered menacingly above us, as if giant bat-winged griffins squatted invisibly on the mountain tops and leered with Abaddon eyes that had looked on transcosmic gulfs. As the afternoon advanced, it became increasingly difficult to see, and we heard the rumble of a thunderstorm gathering over Tempest Mountain. This sound, in such a locality, naturally stirred us, though less than it would have done at night. As it was, we hoped desperately that the storm would last until well after dark, and with that hope turned from our aimless hillside searching towards the nearest inhabited hamlet to gather a body of squatters as helpers in the investigation. Timid as they were, a few of the younger men were sufficiently inspired by our protective leadership to promise such help. We had hardly more than turned, however, when there descended such a blinding sheet of torrential rain that shelter became imperative. The extreme, almost nocturnal darkness of the sky caused us to stumble sadly, but guided by the frequent flashes of lightning and by our minute knowledge of the hamlet, we soon reached the least porous cabin of the lot. A heterogeneous combination of logs and boards, where still existing door and single tiny window both faced Maple Hill, barring the door after us against the fury of the wind and rain. We put in place the crude window shutter which our frequent searches had taught us where to find. It was dismal sitting there on rickety boxes in the pitchy darkness, but we smoked pipes and occasionally flashed our pocket lamps about. Now and then we could see the lightning through the cracks in the wall. The afternoon was so incredibly dark that each flash was extremely vivid. The stormy vigil reminded me shudderingly of my ghastly night on Tempest Mountain. My mind turned to that odd question which had kept recurring ever since that nightmare thing had happened, and again I wondered why the demon, approaching the three watchers either from the window or from the interior, had begun with the men on each side and left the man in the middle till the last, when the Titan fireball had scared it away. Why had it not taken its victims in natural order, with myself second, from whichever direction it had approached? Would that matter of far-reaching tentacles did it prey? Or did it know that I was the leader and saved me for a fate worse than that of my companions? In the midst of these reflections, as if dramatically arranged to intensify them, there fell nearby a terrific bolt of lightning, followed by the sound of earth sliding. At the same time, the wolfish wind rose to demonic crescendos of ululation. We were sure that the lone tree on Maple Hill had been struck again, and Munro rose from his box and went to the tiny window to ascertain the damage. When he took down the shutter, the wind and rain howled deafeningly in, so that I could not hear what he said. But I waited while he leaned out and tried to fathom nature's pandemonium. Gradually, a calming of the wind and dispersal of the unusual darkness told of the storm's passing. I had hoped it would last into the night to help our quest, but a furtive sunbeam from a knothole behind me removed the likelihood of such thing, suggesting to Munro that we had better get some light, even if more showers came. I unbarred and opened the crude door. The ground outside was a singular mass of mud and pools with fresh heaps of earth from the slight landslide, but I saw nothing to justify the interest which kept my companion silently leaning out the window. Crossing to where he leaned, I touched his shoulder, but he did not move. Then, as I playfully shook him and turned him around, I felt the strangling tendrils of a cancerous horror whose roots reached to illimitable past and fathomless abysms of the night that broods beyond time. For Arthur Munro was dead, and on what remained of his chewed and gouged head, there was no longer a face.